That's the Stay Human Band in New York for Stay Human on Northern Community Radio. I'm Michael Goldberg, and I'm just cockeyed with gratitude to find that today's broadcast, the program has been on the air for 1 year. On this first anniversary show, highlights from year one with stories from Matthew Miltich, Annie Erickson, Steve Downing, and others. Stay tuned. If you're old enough to watch TV in the 1970s, here's a blast from the past. And if you're not old enough to have seen or remembered this TV show, it might be that you're still too young to realize that the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Boy, the way Glenn Miller played
songs that made the hit parade.
Guys like us, we had it made.
Those were the days. And you knew where you
were girls and men were men. Mister, we could use a man like Herbert Hoover again. Didn't need no welfare states.
Everybody pulled his weight.
Gee, our old LaSalle ran great. Those were the days.
2 words, said Norman Lear. He was the producer of All in the Family, now 94 years old, still very active as a philanthropist and a social activist. He founded People for the American Way. Among his many awards and accolades, two of his proudest were getting named to Richard Nixon's enemies list and being called by Jerry Falwell the number one enemy of the American family. You know, I was thinking Lear came of age during the administration of Franklin D. Roosevelt, who campaigned for re-election in 1936 by saying, "I ask you to judge me by the enemies I've made." Anyway, the 94-year-old Lear was asked, "How do you do it? How do you keep going? What's the secret to being so engaged at your age?" "Just 2 words," he said, "over and next." It's hard to admit it when something's over. I'm struggling with that now as I witness the end of the unlikely idiosyncratic business that I've been operating for the past 25 years. It's not really a decision I've made, certainly not convenient or responsible in terms of finances. But this sense of witnessing instead of choosing the end of something is the kind of over Mr. Lear is referring to. Could be a job or a career. Could be a marriage or a love affair, could be the loss of a parent or the one friend you could always turn to every time it's an assault on your identity. But this is who I am. So, of course, we struggle against it being over, denial and anger. It's an awful long road to acceptance. We have to face things being over throughout our lives. Even very young children have to cope with adults insisting, "No, you're a big boy now." But the longer you live, the more over things get, including the surprises of a body that just doesn't do the things your body could always do. In my 50s, I was telling a friend that mortality makes us cowards. I told her about my disappointment in my great Aunt Sarah, who had confided to me on witnessing the decline of a much older relative, that she herself would never get to that state, that she would exit long before going that far, with a smile and without regret. Yet, as her health declined, advanced diabetes and who knows what else, confining her to a hospital bed, she just clung to it, agreed to every surgery, every possible way to delay. I told my friend Karen the lesson I'd learned from this story. Fear of death turns us all into cowards. Karen, who was wise even back then, listened to all this and then gently asked, "Michael, do you think you know more now, see things differently than you did 20 or 30 years ago?" "Oh, yeah, of course." "Then why not assume that's also true of our elders, that they have insights, a way of understanding things that we just haven't earned yet?" That conversation came back to me recently when I heard Norman Lear say, "There are 2 words. One of them is over, and the other one is next." And next is every bit as scary as over. Sometimes we say, I can't let this be over until I figure out what's next. But I suspect Mr. Lear, at 94 years, has them in the correct order. We can't see what's next until we recognize and accept what's over. Faith is often characterized as blind because it doesn't have a map or road signs. It's something we can only make a leap of. You don't know what's next, and neither do I. But it's like the diggers of the 1960s used to say in their radical critique of social conformity, be who you are, and if you don't know who you are, find out.
Two medicines, I need them every day. Two medicines, to keep the doctor away. One to drown my sorrows, one to face my fears. Tears. Two medicines, I swear there ain't no crime. Two medicines, and they don't cost a dime. They heal the body, cleanse the soul. Help me master self-control. Two medicines have helped me through the years. Laughter and tears, laughter and tears.
I feel honored in producing this radio program to share stories of spirit and courage by some of the writers who live in northern Minnesota. One of them is Anne-Marie Erickson, sharing excerpts from her forthcoming book, In the Evening We'll Dance. It's a memoir in essays of the last 17 years of her life with her husband Dick Kane, a love story about how she and Dick clung to each other as his dementia slowly overtook him. Annie Erickson.
3 months before he died, my husband said to me, the two of us have been asked to say something wonderful. I'd told Dick that I was writing essays about him. Sometimes I'd ask him if he wanted to hear an excerpt. He always said yes. He'd sit up proudly and smile as I read, but after a few minutes he'd grow restive. He was lost, unable to track the sequence of sentences, the words pouring over him. I'd stop reading, smile at my husband, and then remind him, that's about you. For several years, he'd been unable to read or write because of his dementia. This man who had been a perceptive reader and an adept writer and editor. In his final years, I'd sit or lie next to him, listening intently as he rambled along. I'd inform him that I was taking notes. You say some amazing things, I told him. He seemed pleased. His neologisms fascinated me. His efforts to communicate moved me. Until the end, he could speak with correct syntax. Then he'd arrive at a gap, a word lost or missing or hidden. He'd fling a series of word-like sounds across the chasm, like a makeshift bridge spanning a gorge. Dick would sometimes look back at the sentence he'd just traversed. He'd observe, quite a niff, no, quite a bit. What the hell am I saying? I said niff. That's a new word. After I dashed hither and thither, swatting at a fly, he told me, all you do is go around and hit panky goppers. I typed this delightful coinage into my phone. Autocorrect replaced it with pan kippers. It converted swidget into swishers. For Eves, which he spoke and then spelled out, became phone essays. Frustrated, I'd backtrack, correcting the correction. He might well have felt a similar vexation. The real word resided somewhere in his mind, but he couldn't locate it. I have kept hundreds of these notes in my phone. I've also kept notes, his, mine, on scraps of paper, post-its, and on index cards. They're stuffed into letterboxes, taped into journals, stashed in computer files. The notes are mementos, reminder of who he was, who we were. When I'd misplace a note, I'd grow frantic as I searched. I realized that this might well be how he felt when memories and then words failed him. A wind gust grabs your papers. You chase after them, clutching at as many as you can before they are blown away. I'm terrified of losing you in me. Francisco Goldman writes of the loss of his wife, Aura Estrada, in his memoir, Say Her Name. The reviewer Robin Rahm observes that Goldman furiously attempts to hold on to what can be kept, mittens, hats, rings, as if they have the power to anchor him in the world. Like Goldman, I want to hang on to what can be preserved, photographs, his watch, his glasses, his words. It's a way of keeping both myself and the memory of my late husband anchored in the world. I want to sort through, to piece together, to make sense of. It's ironic that so much of this language relates to memory, which is what Dick lost. I write to remember and to commemorate, to honor the memory of my late husband. Memory is related to the old English word mernan, meaning to mourn.
Annie Erickson's work is supported by grants from the Minnesota State Arts Board and the Arrowhead Regional Arts Commission, which receive funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, as does this and other programs on KAXE, KBXE. And that fund keeps getting replenished every day because every time anyone in Minnesota buys something and pays sales tax, a little bit of it, about 2 cents on a purchase of $30, goes into that fund. And that's why we're relishing such a vibrant arts scene here in northern Minnesota and throughout the state. Today on Stay Human, I'm celebrating the show's first anniversary by revisiting some highlights from 2017. When Mother's Day rolled around, I thought about some of the coolest moms I've ever known, and I called their children and asked them to tell me about advice they got from their mother.
If anybody arrived at our house, they usually ate supper, and her rule of thumb was, for company, there's always enough, just throw in another potato. My mom is Justine Dragovan, and she lived to be almost 103. She said, when you stop being curious, you are dead. And that was because she just didn't like talking to older people who she felt were old because they didn't have that little spark going so that you could have a conversation about more than how your constipation was. So that's my mom's.
My mother, Sophie Paris, who's no longer with us, gave me lots of great advice. And it was mostly around the type of girl I should be seeing and the type of cooking I should be doing. There was probably much more advice on cooking, and it always involved using more garlic and more paprika. You know, she would watch me cook something, and she would always tell me, well, maybe you should add some more, and, you know, it'll taste a lot better.
My mom was June Landon, and the best advice she gave me, she gave to our whole family on her 90th birthday. And we said to her, June, if you can tell us one thing, give us some your best advice. And she said, just be nice.
My mom's name is Gail Addison. She always taught me, when I have a problem, to slow down, take a breath, and find a solution. She's still teaching me that. Lucky for me, she never gives up.
My mom is Karen Noyce, and sometimes I wonder if I'm doing the right thing as a mother. She always has the right things to say whenever I feel like I'm doing something wrong, or I'm questioning myself about me being a mother myself. And it's always nice to be able to go back to her and get advice. And she's always right. She always just tells me to follow my heart and follow my dreams. And she tells me how good of a job I'm doing constantly. And she's just always there.
My mother is Winifred Jane Featherstone Latimer, and she will be 97 in 2 weeks. I'm the oldest of 7 children, and my mother taught us a lot of things, but in a very gentle way. She wasn't an outspoken kind of bossy mother. She was a very gentle mother. And the thing that I can think about her is she taught us to see beauty. She taught us to see beauty in people and in nature. And I know many of your listeners probably know about my brother John and his ability to know about nature, but we all do. And a story that kind of reminds me about Mother is she knew all the animals. She watched every sunrise, every sunset. She still does. And she said one day I was visiting her, and she goes, oh, there's my little prairie dog. You know, he has a lame leg. I mean, she knew them all like they were personal. So, also about people, she never talked down about anyone, regardless of their status or whatever behavior they might have had. And I remember once I was trying to gain favor with her by telling her about one of my classmates that had done something. She had dropped out of college, and I knew my mother really wanted us to be in college. We all, most went. And she said to me very clearly, and I never forgot, I even remember we were standing in the kitchen, and she said, you can't judge what is behind that decision. It has no bearing to what you know. You can't make that judgment. It was like, okay. And I mean, that stuck with me forever.
Happy Mother's Day from Chris Friedlieb, Dan Paris, Peg Landon, Joe Addison Goldberg, Emily Norton Finken, and Sally Latimer. Thanks to each of them for sharing so much good advice with us here on Stay Human. Music by Sheryl Crow. One of the things this radio show is about, at least for me, is reflection and growth. Even though I worked in radio on and off the air for about 10 years, that was way back in the beginning of my career, way back in the analog tape and razor blade 20th century. I'm getting a chance to relearn it now with the blessings of the digital age, and to relearn it with the perspective of age, everything in a different light now. I take a lot of courage from my friends and their self-reflections, as in this piece from Steve Downing, who's a regular contributor to the show. Here he is with the story written for Stay Human called Kansas City.
I graduated from college in 1971 with no sustainable notion of what to do with my actual life, but a functioning near certainty that I had pretty well solved all of life's big idea challenges. You know everything at 21. That summer, I moved to Kansas City, Missouri. The war in Vietnam was on, but was deeply unpopular and winding down. I had recently been classified 1-0 as a conscientious objector by the Selective Service System. The lottery was in effect then. Unless World War III erupted, my number was never going to be called, so I wouldn't be required to perform alternate service. But I felt an obligation. I had friends fighting in Vietnam. With my heavy-duty Catholic background and upbringing, guilt was a component of every calculation. But that background, my personal framing of Catholicism, definitely informed my conclusion that I could never be a soldier. The Catholic messages that most resonated with me suggested that war, fighting, was wrong, would always fail, and was avoidable. When you know everything at 21, your shortcomings look like beauty marks to you. I took a job in Kansas City that would qualify for alternate service, working and living in a halfway house for teenage boys transitioning from reform school back into their communities. The pay was a farce, the working conditions tough and tense. Lots of drama and discord in that environment, I can tell you. So I got into the habit of taking a walk late at night, alone. I needed to talk to myself, The last time I did that, I was jumped by two guys who came at me from behind a car parked at the curb. One of them hollered a name, at least I thought it was a name, in front of a four-syllable word you'll never hear on public radio. I was so startled, I reacted with instincts that were not even mine. I swung and connected with the first guy's face. From the sound and the way my hand looked later, I probably broke his nose. He ran. The second guy and I wound up in a weird, desperate wrestling match on the boulevard. He had some sort of weapon. To me, it looked like a screwdriver, but it was sharp. He nicked my forehead and shredded my jacket. In a minute or so, probably less, we rolled up under a streetlight where he realized I wasn't who he thought I was. I can still see his eyes in that moment. Simultaneously, we both took off in our opposite directions. I don't know about him, but I was surely on the verge of heart failure, and I felt like an animal. The cut on my forehead was marginal. The jacket, a hand-me-down, I wasn't that fond of anyway. And the police helicopter hovered over the neighborhood for a long time afterward, so we all felt safe from any follow-up. But here's the thing. I had wanted and was trying to kill that guy. If I could have, in those several demented seconds, I would have killed him. That knowledge, that self-awareness, changed my world. My naive view of myself as a pacifist went away. My naive belief in an overarching fairness guiding human affairs went away. In a sense, I woke up that night at age 21, thanks to two people I'll never be able to thank. And think about it from their perspective. In 1971, most guys like me looked like me. Long hair, beard, beat-up jeans, beat-up jacket. In the dark, fairness was not guiding my attacker's affairs either.
This ain't no party, this ain't no disco, this ain't no fooling around.
There are so many ways, as we try to stay in the present, stay human, that we revisit, recycle, remember, misremember, and revise our understanding of the past. One of my lifelong friends came to visit this summer, and she told me this story about her summer rituals. Here's Christine Jenkins.
I've always loved the first lines of Natalie Babbitt's now classic children's book, Tuck Everlasting. The first week of August hangs at the very top of summer, the top of the livelong year, like the highest seat of the Ferris wheel when it pauses in its turning. The weeks that come before are only a climb from balmy spring, and those that follow a drop to the chill of autumn. But the first week of August is motionless and warm. It was August 1973. That spring, my friend Dan had moved into a small farmhouse just outside of Hackensack, Minnesota. I had just finished a program in Library and Information Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I was working as a baker and wondering what I was going to do next. So I took a Greyhound bus to Hackensack to spend a few days at Dan's place. Other friends were going to be there too. Dan's farmhouse was the kind of place that my friends were living in those days, if they were living in the country. Worn linoleum in the kitchen, worn and splintery wood floors in the other room, steep steps to the second floor, beds that had been there for decades with old mattresses on top of creaky old bed springs. No plumbing, no problem. Every day or so, we would load up the truck with big plastic jugs, drive over to the cemetery down the road, and fill up our jugs from the cemetery's pump. In the back of the house was a grassy yard, a picnic table, a clothesline, outhouse, faded red barn. Lots of sweet corn, lots of easy laughter. One way or another, there was room for everyone. Every night, we heard the yodel of loons. One night, we saw the northern lights, shimmering green in the sky. One afternoon, we got in the truck, three to the front seat, the rest of us sitting in the truck bed, drove for 20 minutes and pulled over beside a birch woods. There was a twisty path through the woods. At the end of the path, in the midst of birch trees, was a perfect little lake, a perfect little dock, and a perfect little rowboat. We hopped in the rowboat, shed our clothes, and jumped in the lake. Can you see the golden glow around every moment? That long ago summer returned again and again. All I had to do was step on a bus or get in my car and go. I lived in Wisconsin, in Michigan, in Illinois. I was single. I was in a couple. I was single again. I was just coming out. I was out. I was on my way to Ann Arbor to my first year as a school librarian. I was in a committed relationship. I just moved in with my girlfriend. I just moved out, living on my own for the first time. I was on my way to Madison, Wisconsin, to my first year as a doctoral student. I was in love. I was in mourning. I was having a summer fling, wondering what the fall would hold. I was on my way to Champaign, Illinois, to my first year on the faculty of the Graduate School of Library and Information Science. I had long hair, short hair. I was nearly bald after 4 months of chemo. My hair had returned and I was healthy. Each August, we regaled each other with the stories of our lives since the previous August. For those 2 or 3 or 5 days that I was here in northern Minnesota visiting my friends, I was in an in-between place. I was no longer here, but not yet quite there. Every year, I was a little bit different, as were my friends. Some trees were bigger, some were gone. The shag carpeting had disappeared. The new floor tile was installed. Not that every change was positive, of course. That bright and articulate fifth grader was gone, replaced by a silent and sighing teenager. But that little guy with a big smile now had a little guy of his own. Nothing was the same. Everything was the same. As Natalie Babbitt noted, all wheels must have a hub. A Ferris wheel has one, as the sum is the hub of the wheeling calendar. Fixed points they are, and best left undisturbed, for without them, nothing holds together. I mark those fixed points each August in northern Minnesota. August is the end and the beginning. We mourn and celebrate the end of summer, the arrival of fall. Every year in August, I drive two-lane roads in northern Minnesota, Hackensack, Backus, Deer River, Grand Rapids, Bovee, Floodwood, the Itasca County Fair, Tall Timber Days, rain, heat, movies. The constant is the setting and the people. If someone had told me then as I watched the northern lights in Hackensack and wondered when my real life would start, dreaming of traveling the world, hungry for new places, novel experiences, that someday I would also long to see the same people, do the same things, watch the same night sky. And now I have traveled, new experiences, made new friends, but each year I return here.
You're tuned to Stay Human, heard at this hour every week on Northern Community Radio, streaming and archived at kaxe.org. We started broadcasting this show on December 18th of 2016, but I got the idea for it a few weeks earlier. I remember the exact day I got that idea, November 8th, 2016, because that was the day we woke up to the reality of the triumph of Trump and a scary new era in our politics and our social relations. I thought, well, one way I could keep my spirits up is to look honestly at what's happening and celebrate what's best in all of us and in American values of democracy, freedom, and equality. So periodically on this program, I include my thoughts on the political scene. Here's an example from last September on one plotline in the ongoing reality TV show. I take some courage from the flotilla of rubber duckies that are fighting for democracy in Russia. Thousands of people there, many of them born after the collapse of communism, have taken to the streets as one tactic in their struggle against Putin and his fat cat cronies. Those people out in the streets, they're our allies in a worldwide struggle for human dignity and freedom. The anti-Putin forces are committed to ending corruption. Prime Minister Medvedev is accused of building an empire of corruption, including his own luxury properties, yachts, vineyards, even specially constructed houses for his ducks. The freedom fighters, who took to the streets last summer, carried rubber duckies while they chanted, "Putin out, Russia without thieves." See, it's one thing for the police to beat and arrest angry protesters, but it looks pretty different when they're confronted with laughing crowds wearing silly duck hats. Laftivism, this is called, and it's a deadly serious tactic in the disciplined nonviolent struggles of this century so far. Laftivism. Meanwhile, Putin's friends in Washington and the business associates of his business associates are all lawyering up because America is not like Russia. We've still got an independent judiciary and the possibility, at least, that thieves will be called to account. I am pretty sure, though, before this all plays out, we are going to need our own versions of rubber duckies to get the crooks out of power. As part of a criminal investigation into illegal dealings with the right-wing Ukrainian party and other Putin pals, the FBI started tapping Paul Manafort's phone in 2014. That was the year his client in Ukraine was forced out of the country by popular uprising. His job for Viktor Yanukovych was described in a State Department cable as being to change the party's image from a haven for mobsters into that of a legitimate political party. 2014 was the year he was forced out, after which Putin invaded eastern Ukraine, after which Manafort went to work for Donald Trump's election campaign. The FBI got a lot of people worried when it raided Manafort's house last summer. But now that the existence of the wiretap has been revealed, the paranoia has got to be ratcheting up. The president, of course, and all his family members and his extended family, like the vice president and bankers and business partners, senior officials in the White House, all of them have their own lawyers because they got to look after their skins. And anyway, who knows who's going to flip with the prosecutors? I wonder when they're meeting about how to deal with the Mueller investigation, do they check each other first to see if anybody's wearing a wire? It's going to be interesting to find out who Paul Manafort talked to on the phones that were tapped and what else has got this reportedly crack team of federal investigators so cranked up. But I think I might have seen something like this on TV. The prosecutors flummoxed by the wily criminals, the billionaires, as always, skating away, the ruthless head of the family delighted by the ducks in his swimming pool, but unable to control his rage or his appetites.
You woke up this morning, got yourself a gun. Your mama always said you'd be the chosen one. She said you're one in a million, you got to burn the shine. You're born under a bad sign.
Song from The Sopranos, and if you didn't recognize it, you probably can't see the connection between it and the Trump administration. But don't take my word for it. Check out even one or two shows from season one. I think you'll get what I mean. When I started making this program a year ago, I would bring pieces of the scripts over to my neighbor, drafts of what I was thinking of saying over the radio, to try them out loud before a sympathetic but discerning listener. He gave me a lot of encouragement, and before long, he started sharing his writing and stories on the program, too. Matt Miltich is a musician, a writer, a woodsman, a lifelong resident of Itasca County, a father and grandfather, and a veteran of the U.S. Marine Corps. Here's one of his most powerful stories. I asked him for something about relationships with animals, and he gave me this, called Always Faithful.
An hour after midnight, with the second night of a two-night gig finished and my pay collected, I took my string bass to the car and drove back to the apartment provided for their performing musicians, should the players need a place to stay in their little town by the Gunflint Tavern in Grand Marais, Minnesota. I showered, dressed in jeans and a clean cotton shirt, stowed my gear in the car, and left the apartment on my way home despite the hour, and drove through the sleeping town, then for an hour down the dark shore of Lake Superior, then west across the Superior National Forest and the Mesabi Iron Range, and really across the whole of that cool September night, and pulled into the east driveway of my place in the woods, some 15 miles north of Bovee, Minnesota, arriving just a little after 5 a.m. Cosmo, my Welsh Springer Spaniel, sleepy and tousled, his toenails clicking on the steps as he descended the white oak stairway while I opened the door into the house, came down from upstairs to greet me. Always, when I return home, no matter what the hour, no matter how long I've been away, I am greeted with what looks to me like pure joy and love by my loyal canine pal. Sometimes, after playing late in the cities, I fled all the way north in the middle of the night to my home in the woods, driving the long roads between the cities and my place. Well, you don't flee the north shore of Lake Superior, at least I don't, and I can't imagine anyone wanting to get away from such a beautiful shore, such an enchanting, sweetwater sea. But a night drive home after a faraway gig is partly my recognition of a symptom of my particular condition. I hesitate to call it an illness. A legacy from my 2 years in Vietnam, where I served as a U.S. Marine many years ago. Most nights, instead of falling asleep, I lie awake, hyper-alert, and awaiting the least hint of threat, when everyone else, it seems to me, is peacefully asleep. This condition defies every easy solution offered to me by friends and family and physicians and counselors and psychologists, and will not let me go. So I might just as well drive home through the dark night after a gig instead of lying awake in a hotel room or in the spare bedroom of some kind musician friend in a faraway town until I fall asleep, if at last I can sleep at all, or until dawn's light comes up. Besides, Cosmo will be waiting for me at home. Cosmo, my humble bird-hunting partner and my constant companion when I'm home, is an antidote to my condition. A more devoted soul I never will find, I'm certain, than my sweet-faced, kind-eyed spaniel. From the first at 7 weeks of age, he simply accepted me as the most important being on all the earth, and so it continues. Cosmo has a kind of toughness, and I can claim the same for myself. He can hunt hard all day and never falter, just as I can, and if he's on a bird, he's going to find it no matter what hardships its pursuit might pose. But at heart, he's a softy, and I must confess, at long last, despite how tough I've had to be sometimes in order just to survive, am a softy too, and getting softer. During a lifetime of living with dogs as a part of the family from my infancy forward, no human in my family tree before me ever allowed a dog up on the furniture. My old man, bless him and rest him, never allowed a dog of his even inside the house. Until Cosmo became part of life in our house, I never let canine paw touch so much as the seat of a chair. But when young Cosmo jumped into the soft rocking chair in our blue room, a kind of minor sitting room just off the kitchen, I simply let him curl up in that comfy spot, and since he's taken to making himself comfortable wherever he pleases. He likes it comfortable and so chooses the softest furniture, and I like him and indulge him in this, so that's that. Softies. A little more than a year ago, awake in my office at home in the wee hours of a winter's night, too tired to read or write or even to watch television but unable to sleep, I found myself with no warning back on a hill in Vietnam. Most nights when I close my eyes, I see that hill, but this was different. My eyes were wide open. This wasn't a dream, and it wasn't like any sort of waking reality I'd ever experienced before. I found myself suddenly and without transition in precisely the time and place of an event I'd lived in the summer of 1968. Everything about it was as concrete and as real as my surroundings here are real to me this minute. And with my artillery battery on a hill in Southeast Asia, the smells, the feel of the air, the sweat and grit on my skin, the humidity and heat are real. I'm in Vietnam again. It's early morning. In the middle distance below the hill, rice grows pale green in paddies pieced and parceled and hemmed by low earthen dikes. And farther away, dense copses of jungle trees stand here and there, shimmering as the day's heat begins to build. The faraway hills rise dark green from the valley below. A mortar round has just come in but not exploded. Instead, it's lodged in laterite soil just a few feet from me. In 1968, I didn't feel anything much about this. It happened, and that was that. I'd only just awakened after a night of fire missions and gun watch and broken sleep, too little sleep, as always, kind of like now. I was a step or two from the tent where I'd slept in the mortar shell, light olive drab marked with Chinese glyphs, stuck half buried in the dirt. The other Marines on my gun section behind me saw it too, and we laughed. We got right away from that mortar. We called the executive officer on the radio to report it, and then we went about our work on the gun, a 105mm howitzer. A team of OED Marines came and took care of the unexploded ordnance. I never knew what became of that mortar shell. No, it seemed nothing much, unimportant. It hadn't exploded. And in my experience then, plenty of enemy mortars had come in, and though none landed so close to me personally as this one, or I'd not be telling this, all those other mortars had exploded. I'm terrified. More deeply frightened than I was ever in 1968, I stare at the mortar, unable to move. I'm in my own home, yes? But no. I'm on Hill 10 in Quang Nam, Da Nang Province, west of Da Nang, in the Republic of Vietnam, and the unexploded mortar shell juts from the soil just a few feet from me. My guts turn to ice. Somehow, without explanation or transition, after who knows how long, the world changes back, and I'm at home in my dimly lit office once more in the middle of the night. Everyone else is asleep, but Cosmo is right beside me, his warm head against my thigh, and he looks up at my face. I stroke his silky head as my terror subsides. "It's all right, boy," I tell him. "It's going to be all right."
That's Peter Ostrushko in the heart of the country. Thanks for tuning in to this review of 2017 on Stay Human. Northern Community Radio is on the air over 40 years now, thanks to the listeners whose membership contributions pay the bills, and thanks to the listener volunteers whose creative contributions make it worth listening to. I want to thank the radio station staff for their help and support with this program, and all the folks, far too many to mention, who've contributed to it over the past year. I'll be calling on them again in 2018. Please join me next week at this time, Christmas Eve. Terry O'Brien tells a terrific story, returning to our airwaves, and we'll also hear from Rich McClear, founder of Northern Community Radio, with one of his Christmas stories to help us all stay human.
True.